Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching WandaVision. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
I just love the way you say it every time, Richard.
Consistency.
Like Kat Dennings, we are still watching WandaVision. We are here to discuss episode 4. I believe it's titled We Interrupt This Program, or We Now Interrupt This Program. And nothing beyond it. If you are just joining us for the first time, this is a show with three segments. In this first segment, Richard and I are going to respond to listener emails, talk about the episode in general. Richard doesn't have like a hardcore comics knowledge, though I hear he's been doing a little research, so we're going to talk about that.
Very niche research, yes.
So we will be talking about that in this section. The second section, we will have an interview this week. We've got, I believe you pronounce it Elizabeth Olsen. Elizabeth Olsen.
That's how one of her ex-brothers-in-law pronounces it anyway.
Sorry, just got that. Bowls of cigarettes. Okay. Elizabeth Olsen, is here to talk about, the series and sort of, she has some really interesting things to say about, like, the fact that Wanda finally gets to talk to other female characters, which she hardly ever got to do in the MCU. And, also sort of how they're trying to avoid some of the stickier tropes that might come with this storyline. So, I thought that was really interesting interview. She's always very interesting to talk to. And lastly, we've got our colleague Anthony Brezikin will swoop in with some really nerdy stuff. So, you know, we're covering all the bases here on Still Watching. Like I said, we're not spoiling anything beyond this episode because guess what, guys? I don't know what happens next. Not really. I thought this was going to be the Family Ties episode. So did I watch Family Ties yesterday to prepare? Yes, I did. And I was wrong. So I'll be ahead, hopefully, for next week, which should be the Family Ties episode. This is a completely, almost completely out of the sitcom world episode, filling in a lot of blanks. What was your – I just want to get your sort of initial reaction to the episode, Richard.
Well, I appreciated that for those of us who are less familiar with like the Easter eggs and sort of references that have thus far come on the show, that the series did almost to the midway point take a pause and say, okay, like here's what's going on. We're going to explain it in ways that don't feel too heavy on exposition, but that connect it to, you know, the Marvel movies that maybe, I mean, I've seen all of them, but, you know, maybe a more casual viewer has only seen a few of them, to kind of give you the basic, you know, lay of the land in terms of how everything relates to one another. And I think it was done in a way that still felt true to the tone of the series, while also, you know, doing a thorough job of catching us up to speed for the, you know, those of us who kind of hadn't already figured it out.
I Richard is probably phrasing it that way because before the episode started, I was like, I already knew a bunch of this stuff. Oh my God. No, but we did learn some valuable information that I didn't have. I think one of the, most specific things we learned is that this takes place around 3 weeks after, everyone came back from the Thanos snap. So we have like a timeline of like, you know, they defeat Thanos. Wanda goes to Tony Stark's funeral, and this takes place, you know, pretty shortly thereafter, depending on how quickly they had that funeral. So, you know, but still, like, within a couple weeks of when we last saw her. It hasn't been, like, months and months. Because I think Spider-Man, a Spider-Man that we've already had where the gang goes to Europe, that took place months after, the return. So this is a shorter window.
Yeah.
Before we get into all of that, the Kat Dennings and Randall Park of it all, let us talk about some emails. You can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Richard, which emails this week are you wanting to get into?
Well, one of them, from Hollis Boyd, it's a long email sort of filled with theories and things like that. But the central crux of it, I think, really gets at something that this episode further, expanded on. And so Hollis writes, in the dinner scene with the Harts in episode one, once they all sit down and Mrs. Hart starts drilling them with questions, the camera immediately starts showing only Wanda's face. Vision actually only speaks once, saying, "And we were married." And you only see his face from behind and to the side. Then Vision actually seems frozen. He's shot only from behind to the point where you can't even say for sure that it is Paul Bettany sitting in the chair. We only see Wanda trying to figure out why she can't remember their story. Vision doesn't move an inch until Wanda tells him to. Once Mr. Hart begins choking, we again see Vision's face, and he looks distressed, but also locked in place, like Wanda is holding him, and he can't move to help until she releases him or instructs him. It really made me think that this Vision is actually just a part of Wanda, and his growing suspicions are a representation of the part of Wanda that recognizes this is wrong, people are getting hurt, this isn't real, which I think was not confirmed not only by the kind of ending where it shows exactly how Tiana Paris, Monica Rambeau, is expelled from this town, but also in the quick scene where she's talking to Vision and all of a sudden she gasps and we see that he's like dead, like it's his like Vision corpse essentially, and then she kind of snaps out of it and changes him back. So I think that's a keen bit of, you know, observation on Hollis's part, that they've been laying the track work that like this version of Vision really is just another, you know, manifestation of Wanda's mind.
Yeah, there are some questions around that. I think the most, reasonable response to what we saw here, which was like, as you know, a zombified dead Vision that she was somehow like puppeteering. I think that's a really reasonable response, a really macabre sort of reveal, that she's just sort of like, you know, puppeteering her dead boyfriend around this sitcom universe that she's created.
Very Last Dance with Mary Jane, the Tom Petty video.
Yes. Who did it better, Kim Basinger or Paul Bettany? But there's a couple questions around it. Not to get like too nerdy on you, but in Endgame, you might remember that in Endgame, like, or Infinity War, I should say, the whole idea is that they're trying to protect Vision from Thanos, who needs the stone that's in his forehead, right? And they take him to Wakanda because they're trying to figure out a way to remove the stone from Vision's head while still saving him, not killing him, right? And so right. Shuri, Letitia Wright's character, for a significant portion of that whole like battle in Wakanda, is doing something in her lab where she's trying to like redirect all these circuits in Vision's head, like kind of away from the Mind Stone to see if he can exist without this thing that's been powering him. And then she gets dusted, she gets snapped, and it's unclear whether or not she was fully successful. I mean, fans have like pored over screenshots of her monitor and stuff like that, but it's unclear. But then like Thanos rips the stone out of Vision's forehead, and Vision certainly looks dead when that happens. But the question is like, is there some possibility because of what Shuri did before that all happened, that Vision could exist in some form without, the stone in his head? So is there some version of Vision that's still like kind of alive in there? I like this theory, that the emailer put out there, that like the questions that Vision is asking around town when he gets confused or concerned or is interrogating things is an extension of Wanda's, you know, better self interrogating what's going on around her. Mm-hmm. Or is it the remnants of the real Vision sort of still in there? There's a couple possibilities. But, I mean, certainly there's something really creepy going on with Wanda trying to reanimate this person she's lost.
Right. I mean, I also think that it's interesting in the kind of Bewitched episode with the magic show, the talent show.
Yeah.
That Vision is glitching, and there's an intertextual reason for that, which is like he swallowed gum and it, you know, screwed up his gear works or whatever. But like maybe that was a response to an actual like Wanda not necessarily having control over whatever kind of form Vision is in, I guess.
But it's true. I mean, like I did rewatch that scene from the first episode after we got this email. And it's true that Bettany is almost completely frozen. Mm-hmm. She's shot from the back, so you don't really notice it. But, like, his hands don't even move on the table until, like, right as Mr. Hart starts choking, his head moves a little. But, like, he's mostly frozen. And so that is interesting that, like, while Wanda is using all of her processing information and trying to come up with a backstory, she can't also puppeteer Vision at the same time. But we see Vision walking around this universe independent of her. So I don't know. I'm tempted to still think there's something in him that is not her. But we'll find out, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What other emails you want to read out, Richard?
Well, I'm not going to read the full email because it's a lot, and I think some of it actually better pertains to the kind of more intense stuff that you and Anthony are going to get into in the third act of this episode. but Urban Boyer did send us a really fun complimentary email. We appreciate that. But one of the things they mentioned was the third bullet point down in this email was in the comics, Billy, parentheses Wiccan, is gay, but also Tommy, parentheses Speed, is bisexual. And I thought, okay, who are these people? I kind of had done this research before the email, but it was the same thought process of Wanda and Vision have these twins. You don't have a kid in any sort of mythology thing like Marvel or Star Wars without that kid coming to bear at some point, right? Like they don't just forget about. It's not like you know, the sister on Boy Meets World or or the son on Mad Men or something.
Yeah,
but so Billy Wiccan, Wiccan is his like Marvel name, I guess, is gay, which led me down a rabbit hole, one that is adjacent to other rabbit holes I've been down, whether it be back in the day, Harry Potter / fic, or, I guess more recently, I don't even know if I should say this, but I recently have been replaying the game Breath of the Wild, the Legend of Zelda game, and there is actually, I was curious, not out of any prurient interest, I just was curious if there was Link, like / fic, and there is, of course. But anyway, yeah, Billy is this gay character in the Marvel Universe. He has a boyfriend, I think later a husband, who's kind of a Hulk.
Hulkling, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so it really was a funny couple, internet journeys where I started just kind of like trying to do like back, you know, research for this podcast, and then ended up like in this weird spot of like, I wish I'd had this when I was a gay teenager. And like, so you have this weird kind of envy longing thing, but also it was cool. And I'm excited to see, you know, if what they ever do with this character in the cinematic universe or the TV universe. But yeah, if anyone listening to this who was not aware of this development in the Marvel world and would be interested in it, you can go look up in various forms, pictorial, textual, all of the stuff about Wiccan and his journey to being one of the very few out gay Marvel mm-hmm. characters.
I knew that about Wiccan. I talked about last week with Anthony about Wiccan being, you know, canonically gay. I had forgotten that Speed was also bisexual. So, I got some tweets correcting me that Wanda has two queer sons. So yeah.
And of course she does. She's like a fabulous, like witch, like obviously.
Obviously, we're not sure what's going to happen with Billy and Tommy, but something that Anthony and I were talking about was this idea that Marvel right now is doing a lot of work to seed these younger characters into its universe. So I don't know how much this stuff is on your radar, Richard, but there's an upcoming Miss Marvel show. There's a young character named America Chavez that's been cast. There's Hailee Steinfeld is going to be playing this young apprentice of Hawkeye called Kate Bishop. They're just basically they've cast a bunch of these younger superheroes, almost teen, you know, Peter Parker, of course, being one, and sprinkled them throughout various like shows and movies that they have upcoming. So it feels to me like they're building up towards some sort of young Avengers, event. And there is a young Avengers like comic and, Wiccan and Speed are part of the young Avengers. So it feels like this could be all part of leading up to that, if that makes sense.
I did see some, you know, dream fan casting online that was like, Troye Sivan should play Wiccan, which, you know, of course, that's exactly what people are saying. I mean, they do kind of look similar, the drawings.
I would love one of the sort of like most crackpot theories, because like people like to pore over, IMDb casting, to try to figure out what's going on any of these shows. Mm-hmm. And so there is, a young man listed as Boy Next Door, in an upcoming episode. And, that made some fans hope that like, because, we expect to see these kids grow, you know, given how quick Wanda's pregnancy was, we expect to see these kids grow quickly. And so someone was like, I mean, maybe we might watch Wanda try to like help one of her sons through like a crush on a boy next door. Like that would be a really fun thing to have happen in the series. So
if this show,
you know,
that would be fun. I would really, I would appreciate, a little Love, Simon, sprinkled over the MCU. They're all owned by the same company at this point, so might as well.
I know. Why not? And we don't know, you know, if we do get a teen or adult Billy and Tommy, we don't know who might be playing them. So
I just looked up the actor who plays Boy Next Door on Instagram, and there is, in fact, a post about being on WandaVision wearing – he's wearing the sweatshirt. And so it leads me to believe it's not just a little, like, walk-on extra role.
All right. Well, I mean, we'll keep our eye out for the Boy Next Door. All right. So is there anything else you want to touch on in our emails?
Those were the kind of two big things for me. Did anything jump out at you?
Oh, did you want to read the email about the doll?
Oh, God. Right. Yes. How well, fitting that I should forget poor Katie Carriel. Chris writes to us, very nice things again about the show. Thank you for all of that. Then they write, just a quick note of omission. It's an homage to trivia, not an MCU Easter egg. That was the baby that they were changing in the third episode. That was Katie Carriel that Vision was diapering, Cindy Brady's doll. She was tragically lost or doll-napped in an episode of The Brady Bunch, and I remember it gave me some serious childhood trauma that cute little Cindy was so devastated. So I hope some of our WandaVision mysteries are brought to a reveal that doesn't traumatize us as much as Cindy missing Katie Carriel, which I appreciate. I mean, I've definitely seen that episode. It was also parodied in at least one of the Brady Bunch movies. I think the first one, maybe the sequel. I think that's a great little good eye for, all the many ways that this show is referencing closely its source material, not source material, but its reference points.
So something that we got a couple emails about that, like, I don't want to dive too deeply into it because, I like to keep you in your pure state, Richard, as much as possible, but
not a little less pure after doing Wiccan fan fiction dives, but yes, pure enough.
Pure enough. Something I want to, this a detail in this episode is so we learn a few things about the bubble. We learn that, it did not exist. It seems before a couple of weeks ago, that implies to me that Wanda had wandered into someone else's bubble and sort of taken it over. That was a theory. But it seems to me that Wanda is instrumental in the creation of this bubble, given the timeline, given that it was a normal town in New Jersey, before a couple of weeks ago, right? Or a couple days ago, as it were. Then they assemble this sort of like, given their observations, they assemble this wall, that lays out that a bunch of the characters that we've met in the town are actually like people who lived in this town, Westview, in New Jersey, right? And, they've got their real world driver's license attached to their files on the wall. But there's two significant omissions that I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
Number one, Catherine Hahn's character, Agnes, does not have a driver's license attached to her piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
She's the only one. And number two, Emma Caulfield's character, Dottie, is not even on the wall at all. So what does this do for you? What does this mean to you?
Well, I think we talked about it in an earlier recap episode where it was like, you don't cast Catherine Hahn unless there's something big coming for her, I don't think. And I know that there are people, I've seen rumblings in emails we've received and just in general, just like Twitter. I'm trying not to do like read much about the show beyond what we talk mm-hmm. about here, or Wiccan fanfic. That she's maybe a villain. And I think you and Anthony might have talked about that. I don't listen to your parts of the episode again because I don't want to be unpure, impure. So I think that's interesting. And then as far as like, so maybe there's a more sinister reason for why she would be off the grid a bit more than these other people. And then Dottie, I don't know. I almost wonder the way that she was played by Emma Caulfield and just sort of functioned with the glass breaking and everything. I wonder maybe she has more in line with a sort of vision-y robotic thing, or I don't know, maybe she is a creation in a way that the other people who are sort of trapped are not.
There's an interesting line in that episode when they're talking about sort of the neighborhood politics. I believe it's Agnes who says that Dottie's the key to everything, which has a lot of people wondering, like, interesting. And once again, like, not that Emma Caulfield is like, I don't know, but you and Anthony and I all had the same reaction where we're like, Emma Caulfield's in this. Oh my gosh. Anya. So, I don't know that you just cast Emma Caulfield to play Queen Bee of the neighborhood. I feel similarly about mm-hmm. her. So we are going to have our eyes on those two women, I think, specifically. There's also this something to look out for is, you know, the cops say, we're not from this town. We're from Eastview. It's View, right? Not Field. Westfield. Westview.
View, I think. That. Yeah.
We don't. Westview. Okay. They're like, we're from Eastview, right? And so a bunch of people have mentioned this idea of the Wizard of Oz sort of imagery. Scarlet Witch maybe then being Wicked Witch of the West or stuff like that. There's a lot of witchy Aussie stuff going on. So we'll see how that all pans out. But just something to keep your eye open for. And if you see other Wizard of Oz sort of references, to keep that in mind. All right. But, you know, mainly this is an episode where we get a lot of sort of like fun exposition reveals from two MCU characters, Kat Dennings' character Darcy, who comes from the Thor movies, and Randall Park's character Jimmy Woo, who comes from Ant-Man and the Wasp. Just so I don't get an email about this, he does a little sleight of hand trick with his business card when he first meets Captain Monica Rambeau, and that is a reference to Ant-Man and the Wasp. He's trying to like learn magic, that trick in Ant-Man and the Wasp, because he sees Paul Rudd's character do it. So just stop writing your emails saying like, you missed this. I didn't miss it. I saw it. Okay. So what did we learn that's most interesting to you, Richard, in this episode?
Well, I think the most interesting thing for me was honestly the opening and watching the blip, as they call it, be undone in kind of real time. You know,
yeah,
we saw that. Yeah. We saw the moment when people evaporated or turned into dust or whatever. And then we saw in Endgame when they were back, but we didn't see them come back, you know?
Right.
And I think that visual was really interesting. At first, I didn't really know what was going on. And I was like, oh, right, of course. Like, this is, and I really appreciated the way that, like, you know, it's kind of like a zombie movie thing, or like Walking Dead, or 28 Days Later, where she wakes up in the hospital. She wakes up to chaos. And she thinks it's chaos of her time period, but it's 5 years later, you know, 5 years later chaos. And I appreciate whenever these big spectacular movies were really, you know, fantastical supernatural things happen, whenever they can take a moment to like get lower to the ground and show what this would seem, what it would feel like, and to regular people like trying to live their lives. You know, I think that Batman versus Superman, which is a movie that I actually don't think is like that bad. I appreciated in the beginning of that movie when we were introduced to Ben Affleck's Bruce Wayne, that like it takes place during this like city destroying battle from Man of Steel. And it's like, there were people down there when those buildings were collapsing and stuff.
Right.
And I think that was a good way for them to address this kind of mounting criticism that there's not really any attention paid to the fact that what we're seeing in these big action scenes is like millions of people dying. And so I like that they are like, here are just some, I mean, Monica's not regular herself. She's in the closer to the center of all this kind of intrigue, but regular people at the hospital just like freaking out and being like, what is going on? I like when they can humanize all of this wild stuff. And I think they did that really well.
Yeah, I was actually kind of bothered by the way it was handled in Far From Home, the Spider-Man film. I understand that like massive amounts of trauma and grief don't fit with a sort of like fun, young, zippy tone of a Spider-Man movie. But being gone for 5 years, and especially in Monica's case, losing her mom, not being able to say goodbye to her mom, you know, because she was snapped, that's heavy trauma. Like in Far From Home, it was so weird to me. These kids just like go back to high school and all of their classmates have graduated. It's been 5 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they're back at school. And I just thought that that was so bizarre. And, you know, like I said, more time has elapsed in that film, but I'm glad that we get to see this more immediate and very traumatic. It was shot, you know, I've mentioned before, Matt Shakman is a Game of Thrones director, among other things. And it was shot very Battle of the Bastardy, like in the midst of chaos, you're following this one character through the hallways and stuff like that. I thought that was really effective.
Yeah, and it reminded me of when I was a kid, my dad used to read my sister and I a story every night and then like tell us a story that he kind of made up. And sometimes, usually I would fall asleep before that second story was over and then wake up the next morning. But sometimes I would fall asleep and then wake up like after my father had turned off the light and gone upstairs to his bedroom. And it was this feeling of like, and I was really little, but like of like real loss, like waking up into something and being like, oh my God, like they're gone. Like, you know, and I think that just having Monica wake up like that, sitting in the, you know, in the chair by her mother's bed, that's like a really sudden jolt of, of change, you know? And I think that that's a really quick, but efficient and thorough way to like give this character like, pathos and a backstory, you know? So I thought that was handled, well. I mean, she kind of does seem to move past it pretty quickly as the episode goes, but maybe not, you know, maybe that she's just trying to get the job done and there will be some later moment of reckoning.
Yeah, it's there's one theory I kind of liked that I saw this morning, which was that Monica was like, you know, Jimmy, the character Jimmy, who asked the question like, what, how can we be aware of this town? Or maybe she asked the question, how could we be aware of this town when these cops, like there's this selective amnesia. We find out later on the whiteboard, it's like a 5-mile radius around the town. There's this like selective amnesia where the people who live around this town, this New Jersey town, have forgotten that it exists, right? As like sort of a defense mechanism for the bubble. But that doesn't affect, Jimmy and Monica. And not only that, but Monica, unlike it would seem a lot of other people, is able to permeate the bubble, right? Yeah. They can send drones in. They send this poor guy in a hazmat suit in through the sewers. We don't know what happened to that guy, by the way. Like,
nor have we seen his face.
True.
Right?
But yeah, IMDb has him listed as just like a Marvel stuntman.
Oh,
so
okay.
Like, I think he's just like a guy in a suit. But we saw Monica be ejected from the bubble, but we didn't see what happened to the beekeeper hazmat guy. So I'm a little worried about him. But Monica is able to permeate the bubble in a way that maybe not everyone can, it would seem to me. And one theory I saw that I really liked is this idea that maybe her grief is what allowed her to do that. The fact that she's grieving and Wanda's also grieving. And the fact that this is like a pocket universe that's meant to, help soothe someone who's grieving. There's no hard evidence for that. I just kind of like that as an idea. So,
yeah.
And then, yeah, and then, so, you know, so then like Kat Dennings and a bunch of other, scientists swoop in and we find out some details, about the bubble, about, the one really interesting thing I want to mention is this idea of like what's being edited and when, because we've seen these sort of like little blips and rewinds that Wanda does already. But we got to see that, whereas they don't get to see it at all. And they're just getting like the cut vision, as someone says, like someone's editing the broadcast, right? Mm-hmm. But what also seems to be true is they're getting more episodes than we are, because Kat Dennings' character has this line, Darcy has this line where she says like, she washes dishes about once an episode, barf.
Yeah.
Like, you know, she got to see all of like season one or whatever, and we didn't. So, you know, they're operating with a little bit more data than we have. But yeah, so my question, you know, to you is, this episode ends and Monica says, you know, it's Wanda, she's doing everything, it's all her. Do you think that's right? What do you think?
Yeah, I think from what we have in front of us now, yes. I think the question for me now is why? Because we kind of saw, I mean, obviously grief is can be a very long process, a very complicated dynamic process that keeps changing. But we saw in Endgame, where she has her, you know, face off with Thanos, that like, yeah, she has, you know, she's like, you took everything. It's like, okay, so she's processed that he's dead. And then they have to defeat this thing and save the world. And then they have to have Tony's funeral, which maybe was a Catholic funeral. Maybe it happened like the next day. So you kind of think she's further along in the acceptance part of things, or toward the acceptance part of things. So this would almost seem a bit like a regression. But you know, who knows, what the kind of psychological, you know, mechanics of that are. I think another question of why is why TV, like why these shows, like where is Wanda in relationship to this kind of American pop culture arcana? And the only thing I could think of is what is the name of the country?
Sokovia.
Sokovia. Cause Krakoa is like the one from the terminal with Tom Hanks. Anyway, is maybe that was just like all that was available of like American culture was just these old TV shows when she was a kid or something. I don't really know her backstory. So,
Elizabeth Olsen gave an interview, I think it's to Emmy Magazine, where she said that like this is a reflection of the American reruns that Wanda grew up watching in sort of the Eastern Bloc,
right?
As a kid,
Which would make some sense that like after all the trauma of her young life, her brother dying, her lover dying, also having to like constantly fight to save the world, which would take a toll on people physically and mentally, I would have to imagine, that she retreats to this like the most arch of kind of stereotypical happy living, you know, and the only example that she has. And I think we were talking a couple episodes ago about her becoming more ascendant in her powers, that this is something that she clearly has some control over, but that like there is a psychic aspect to it that is instinctively protective in a way that she maybe doesn't have control over. Like, you know, there is a kind of id part of her that is doing this rather than a high kind of consciousness. So I guess what right now I think that the arc of this run of this series, this one, you know, whatever this is, the first season, I don't know, is her coming to terms with both the fact that she lost her great love, but also that she's so powerful that she, like, you know, any of the telepath X-Men before her, has to kind of keep a tighter lid on herself than other people do, which is a tragedy in itself, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me. I'm not fully convinced that she is completely in control of everything here. I mean, you mentioned like this sort of potential id control, but I think episode 4 is too early of an episode for us to get an answer of who's behind everything. And there's also, I won't go too deep into it, but for example, in last week's episode, when she was trying to get the like stork to go away, mm-hmm. her magic wasn't working on it. And, you know, so there are things she's not in control of sort of emotionally. Then there's moments like that where like her own powers don't actually work. Then I wonder if there's someone else, if she created the bubble, maybe there's someone else exploiting her within the bubble, you know, and perhaps that's the Agnes figure, perhaps it's someone else, but,
right.
Like that she's not the ultimate big bad of this season, but we might come to view her more as a victim of it, in a way, you know?
Right. Maybe her kind of grief and power are being exploited, right. Which would then of course lead us to ask like to what end, like what right. Is someone trying to like get her to bring Vision back so they can control this like all powerful techno being, or are they just trying to harness Wanda's powers, or is there some other revengey thing in mind? I mean, I don't know, but
right
it's clear to me that like metaphorically this thus far this could be read as like how grief and other strong emotions can mm-hmm. make us act outside of ourselves in seemingly irregular ways because an unconscious part of ourselves is trying to process things.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that assessment. I think the performance, the great layered performance Elizabeth Olsen gives after Wanda kicks Monica out, where she has this like, you're a threat, you know, I need to get rid of you because you're threatening, you know, my fantasy here, right? So I need to get rid of you. But then there's immediate like fear of self and sort of regret, right? That plays on her face. She gets a little teary eyed. Yeah, I think there's a lot going on here. The other thing I'll say to your point, is that in a press conference, I don't know what the context was, but I have seen footage of someone asking Kevin Feige who the most powerful Avenger is. And, this is after Endgame. And he said, well, if you look at Endgame, Wanda almost had Thanos. He had to call in all of his backup to like get rid of her. She almost took out Thanos herself. So his answer was Wanda. And that's both canonically true. It might, that's a little bit of good advertising for his upcoming show, WandaVision, yeah. Which I'm sure is like partially on Kevin Feige's mind, but it's also true. You know, she can alter reality. She's way too powerful. Way, way, way too powerful. And you mentioned psychically connected X-Men before her. So like, you know, Dark Phoenix is of course the most famous version of that storyline, but like that this is, this is a power that needs some sort of check to it, especially when she's endured so much trauma, and is so emotionally volatile.
I'm writing this like kind of fan fiction series about like Wiccan when he first starts going to gay bars and he doesn't realize that he's really cute. And so he has this power that he can't really control. And he's like, why is everyone bothering me? You know, it's that kind of thing. Exactly. Very similar to my own youth.
Exactly. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about in this episode?
No, I just, you know, I want to, you know, please people subscribe and listen to Wiccan Cast, the new show that I'm doing alone in the dark. I think it was a fun episode. I've no doubt that people will be eager to get back into the kind of sitcom conceit, myself included. But I appreciated this episode for kind of expanding the world or at least putting, you know, some parameters around it, without giving away the game entirely.
I think it'll be fun to hopefully split time because I think some people are feeling a little suffocated being only in the sitcom world. Yeah. I think it'll be great to sort of split time going forward. I felt a little like antsy in this completely non-sitcom episode. So I think there's really good potential for a balance going forward. Now I'm just looking at images of Wiccan and Hulkling. All right. So
I psychically
Richard
sent
has
those
once
to you.
Again yep. infected my mind. Yep. All right. So you know, to circle back to this idea of emotional volatility, this is something that Elizabeth Olsen and I specifically talked about. So here is our conversation with Elizabeth Olsen.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
I wanted to start off by asking you, I've loved the Wanda character throughout the MCU, but I've always been desperate for her to have like one close female friend, right? Most of the people that you've interacted with in the MCU have been the men, Jeremy Renner, Paul Bettany, et cetera, et cetera. So excited to see you bounce off of Catherine Hahn and Tiana Paris. And what was it like for you to take this character and give her some sort of female reflection?
It is such a joy. I mean, just as like, aside from the characters, it is such a joy. Like I, you know, getting to know Catherine and getting to know Tiana, especially being such fans of both of theirs, is just the greatest gift. The female actors don't get to work with other female actors that often. It's like, like a lot of men do, but like women don't really get that opportunity. So that in its own right was just so much fun. But then also for her to have, especially through the sitcom eras, for her to have her like girls and her alliances is really important. Her trying to navigate this fitting in of this new neighborhood. And I think the relationship with Catherine's character specifically becomes one that's like very needed for her.
One of my favorite quotes that I've read from you over the years is something that you said about how you were promised that you would never have to wear the Scarlet Witch comic book costume. And of course you're wearing it here, and in the trailers we see it. We haven't seen it on the show yet. It's a cute little like winking Halloween costume nod to it. But what was the conversation like when they brought it to you and you were like, I was told I was never gonna wear this? Did you have any of that feeling?
I was so excited. Actually, we have a Halloween episode and they were trying to figure out how big of a nod to the character we were going to do. And it didn't start off with the classic Scarlet Witch costume. It was kind of like a gypsy thing that has to wear a headband. And I like fought for it. I was like, no, we have to go full into it. Like we have to, this is like the greatest thing. If Paul's doing it, I'm doing it. And so it was, and I'm really in it. It's not just a flash. I'm really in the costume for quite a bit. And it was so fun. I loved it. And it was the perfect way to wear that costume because you can't take that costume seriously.
Right, right. But in the context, you're like, give me the headdress, give me everything. I'm gonna
do it. And make the headdress as big as you need to. Massive.
I'm wondering, you know, as you hop and skip through these family sitcom eras, these different show homages, was there an era you were most comfortable with, either because you grew up watching it or it just fit your acting style?
I felt like I knew the 80s episode pretty well. It's our like family ties episode, which is also, you know, obviously what people from the late 80s, early 90s grew up with, which is, you know, Step by Step, Full House, and those the Torkelsons. And there's my favorite thing about those shows is they are just, you know, so sincere. And there are so many teachable moments with the sad, you know, music that comes in that makes everyone go, aw. And I just thought that was very fun to get to play with, especially because the way we play with those teachable moments has a bit of MCU in it. And I thought it was clever the way we handled those moments.
It's so fun watching you get to play this evolution of wives and moms as they're represented through these various eras, you know, thinking about what a Laura Petrie is versus a Samantha versus a, you know, through Meredith Baxter Burney, et cetera. You know, and I was wondering if you had any sort of thoughts about, and then you get to like something like Roseanne, right? Which is blowing up any sort of ideals of perfect suburbanhood and stuff like that. Yeah. I was wondering if you had any sort of personal revelations about how we thought about wives and moms through these like family sitcom representations.
Well, the funny thing is the most consistent thing in these shows is that the women are the straight players, like starting with Mary Tyler Moore and Dick Van Dyke. She plays the straight man and he plays, you know, the bumbling idiot. And, right, you know, even with Elizabeth Montgomery being, you know, her show with Bewitched, she's still the straight man. Her husband's a bumbling idiot. And that really stays consistent. It's almost like, you know, we don't allow women to be funny. So that's why when humor almost becomes really cynical, that's when like women get their like starring moment to be the funny ones for whatever reason that is, like, you know, but comedy became very cynical in the aughts. At least the sitcoms did with like Malcolm in the Middle. And it's an opportunity for women to be also very funny instead of just being the straight, you know, reflection. But then you have I Love Lucy, which I tried to bring a bit into in the 70s with a lot of the physical humor. And, you know, she's just comedy gold. But for the most part, the consistency, that's like, feels very consistent, which is, you know,
strange. That is interesting. Yeah, absolutely. You've talked about how, you know, in this series, we finally get to see you play some of the comic book storylines that maybe Joss Whedon presented to you in the first place to get you excited about this character. You know, some comic book fans might feel like they know what that is. We're not going to necessarily say what it is because that would be giving the game away. But, you know, coupled with Kevin Feige talking about you and Paul being these tremendous, tremendous actors who he has sort of felt like he regrettably had to keep a bit in the margins of this large, in a large ensemble setting. I'm wondering if over the years in the MCU, you've ever been like, hi, when are we getting to that thing that I want to do? And have they told you over the years, it's coming in some form, I promise.
It's almost like the opposite, actually. Oh, yeah. I've only signed on for a couple at a time. So mm-hmm. every time they ask me to come back, it's a surprise to me. Cause I just keep thinking, well, we're done with this, you know, chunk, and we're done with this chunk. And so I think what happened for me was I started getting like really comfortable not having the responsibility for, you know, the success or failure of the Avengers franchise.
Yeah.
And just was like really happy to take up like my little corner. And I really enjoyed how they had used me, you know, through, cause I felt like I always had something substantial to do in those films. And when Kevin proposed this show, I think I was like completely freaked out by it because I know how many eyes are on these shows or films, and it's very intimidating. And it just became something that I absolutely adored and loved. And because of this show, it made me love this character more than I ever had. And it makes me feel like I have such new ownership of her because of the time I got to spend creating this show. And now I'm like excited for the next, now I'm like excited for the next thing. No one had told me that. I mean, I just signed on just because I liked the character because of the comics. And I thought, you know, the Age of Ultron story was really powerful and fun and angsty and rebellious and like really like an honorable story to tell. And now it's this completely new thing that it never was at the beginning. And going and like from the transition from WandaVision to Doctor Strange too, I just feel like it's also earned.
No, I think that's right. One thing that I think is interesting about, like, I love the, you know, some of the big Wanda comic book storylines. You talk about like angsty and stuff like that. There have been some critics who have pushed back on the way in which Scarlet Witch's, some of her biggest eruptions are tied to like emotion and motherhood and stuff like that. And there have been some critics who wonder, you know, if men are really the ones to sort of write those storylines and is that how we want to think about this right. very powerful female character? So I'm wondering if you A, have any thoughts on that, and B, you know, how much does it matter that there is a woman running this particular show?
Well, I mean, that is an interesting thing to think about because she largely represents mental health within the comic book stories. And to just create hysterical women isn't really that interesting of a story, and also doesn't really help any causes.
Right.
But to create a story about someone who believes so deeply in their own like cause and their own experiences, and to tell a story about trauma and resilience and what's the word I'm looking for? Like avoidance. There's a lot of things that her story is, and whatever moments of like extreme power and emotion that has come out of it, I think that I understand that it's like the fear of the hysterical woman, but I also think it's like incredible for someone to have that kind of connection to their emotional life. And I think in this show, with Jack at the helm, we created such a like revolution for her. And she's gone. It's, I think of this show as, you know, in therapy, some therapists believe or classically believe that you need to talk to like the child that lives inside of you and connect with those experiences that have been trauma. And then you take accountability and you have maybe like a intervention with yourself and you can move forward in a different way in your life. And I do feel like this show represents this kind of therapied experience, which maybe it is female, but there's nothing wrong with that being female, because that means it's evolved thinking. And it means that you don't have to just be this reactive person in the world, that you can take ownership of your life experience and make that power you up for the rest of your life. And so I do think that's what this show does, because we had Jack at its helm, and it could have just been, you know, this kind of interesting trope of a show. But that's really the gravity of the show, I believe, with Wanda.
I think that's fascinating. My last question for you, sort of piggybacking off of that, is, you know, you joined the MCU about like 6 years ago or seven, I guess, at this point, something like that. Have you noticed an evolution in sort of what women are allowed to do, or what female fronted stories this Marvel universe is interested in telling in those years?
I think so. I mean, yeah, I mean, I really think so. And I think it starts with Scarlett. Scarlett's like a Johansson. She's a very powerful, talented woman in the MCU. And I believe that she, you know, maybe she didn't have the first franchise film, but she really created that space. She's quite a pioneer who takes up space and gets heard and does it elegantly and with a lot of intelligence. And I think Kevin has always been a good listener and good at responding to like what the world, you know, is asking for from MCU when it comes to representation on all platforms. And so I really do think when it comes to like the female presence, I feel like Scarlett, you know, was welcomed into the door in the Iron Man films and just really busted it down.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All right, Anthony, here we are. This episode is called We Interrupt This Program. And so, you know, we press pause on the sitcom of it all to give us some external analysis. A lot of this is stuff that we had sort of cobbled together, that we get some confirmation and narrowing down to some theories. I just wanted to start by overall asking you, like, you know, what did you think overall of this episode?
Well, this is what I really enjoyed about the episode was I felt like we were agents of S.W.O.R.D., you and I, We've been trying to crack this, and we're, like, pretty good. I think we're pretty spot on with what's been going
on. Yeah, we did okay.
You know, we realized that the people in the town were, real people drawn into roles. We kind of had figured it out a little bit that Wanda was in this bubble, and, you know, what I really enjoy. So we got some answers also on, like, who was watching them and how they were watching them. Kat mm-hmm. Dennings' character returns from the Thor movies, and I really enjoyed her in this.
If I'm being really fully honest, I think I prefer Darcy more as, like, a side character than a main character of an episode. But I imagine that will be her role kind of going forward. And I am really excited she's here because I do love her in general. And I think, you know, they'll have the option to cut to her, you know, when they return to the sitcom world. We can cut to her watching, which will be fun. So I'm really glad she's here.
Her character is a strong cup of coffee. But here's one of the reasons I really liked it is she reminded me again, of us. Like, she reminded me of, like, a TV blogger. Like, somebody who has super strong opinions, and but yet can find herself surprisingly moved by what she's watching, even though she knows it's a manipulation. Like, I don't know. I actually liked her more in this, but we can disagree about that, I suppose.
I think, yeah, I definitely think that line where she's like, what? I'm invested. That's definitely like a meta line to us. But no, it's interesting. You know, some theories were confirmed, others weren't. Jack Schaefer gave this long, interview to our colleagues over at The Hollywood Reporter, their, TV podcast. And they asked her, the showrunner of WandaVision, they asked her, like, you know, what do you make of all these theories that are floating around? She's like, some of them are hilariously wrong. And some of them are, you know, it's fun basically for her to see them. And so I want to start out by saying sometimes a drone is just a drone. I thought that little thing was a full-size helicopter. It's just a drone, albeit, yes, altered to better fit into Wanda's reality. We saw that alteration work on a guy in a hazmat suit, but it was not a full-size helicopter as the fans had convinced me what it was.
To be fair, Wanda and Vision heard a tremendous crash outside their window.
Yeah.
Before the appearance of the little plastic drone. So I think, like, it was not outside the realm of possibility to assume that there was something bigger than a little toy that crashed, you know, but it did turn out to just be a small remote controlled helicopter.
A lethal drone. Something I do want to say about that, there's this fun theory that I've seen floating around, is that the reason that things switch to color at the end of episode 2, and episode 3 I think is called Now in Color, is not just because we're, like, progressing through the eras of sitcoms, but because those intrusions of colors, whether it's the drone or the blood on Dottie's hand, was disrupting Wanda's fantasy. And so then once it's in color, those color intrusions will no longer irritate her vision. Do you like that theory? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most profound theory, but okay. Sure.
No. Well, I mean, it kind of speaks to
how she's adjusting her reality.
Did she do that, or did someone else do that to keep her from noticing aberrations? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we could talk about that in a second. But let's talk first about this sort of pocket universe, this bubble that appears to be Wanda generated. One question that Jimmy Woo asks in the episode is, why is it? What's with the hexes? Why is it hexagonal shape? Because we get an overhead of the bubble, and it's in a hex shape. So one easy answer is that because Wanda made it. And her powers in the comics are called hex powers. So there's that.
Hexagons and hexes are kind of common to witches, right?
Right, exactly. Or is it a pentagram? Or is it some folks have noticed that the hexagonal shape is really common to, like, the Pym tech. Could it be related to those kinds of universes and realities that Hank Pym, that is explored with Hank Pym and Ant-Man? But I like the sort of, like, it's a pentagram idea. That's what I'm into. What do you think?
Well, you know, why not go full Satan? Sometimes that's okay. What we were talking about the last episode, about the sort of demonic elements and the magic elements that they're drawing into the Marvel Universe. I could see that, sure.
Yeah, because often pentagrams are like, well, from everything I know about stories which come from, I mean, I guess if it were a pentagram, it would be five-sided, right? So,
well, the pentagram is like a star shape.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the star shape and I just counted the sides to make sure I wasn't being dumb, and it looks like five sides, right? If you connect the dots, you get a pentagon. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So maybe it's a hexagram. I would love for it to be that. Anyway, and we learn, you know, we learn that the bubble is relatively new, so it means it's not like someone else's bubble that Wanda wandered into, but like a new thing that probably she created, whether or not she's the one fully in control of it. What do you think of, like, what's your idea of what's going on with this bubble at this point?
Well, I don't know that she necessarily created it, because she's clearly, like, in control of it, right? So they've put her behind the wheel, so to speak. But who created the vehicle and why?
Right.
And she's the missing person they're looking for, right?
No. Because Jimmy said it's someone in WITSEC, and he used a masculine pronoun.
Oh, okay. That went past me. But, okay.
And he was, like, surprised to see her in there. So I have my theories about that. Do you want to skip over to the missing person thing?
Okay. Let's skip to the missing person.
So they create this board, right? And I talked to Richard about this a little bit. Like, almost everyone except for Agnes has a driver's license clipped to their piece of paper, and they're all residents of Westview, New Jersey. They have Westview addresses on there. So they were in the town when the bubble were created, and they've been sort of drafted into these roles, right? Agnes is an exception. We've talked plenty about why Agnes might be an exception. Dottie is not on there. That's Emma Caulfield's character. I have a lot of thoughts about that. And then who is this missing person? We actually got a theory email about that from one of our listeners, Michael, sort of tangentially related. We were talking about this character of Ralph, whether or not Agnes's absent husband was that we would see him, was a villain behind things, was maybe Mephisto. I mean, these are all question marks. Sometimes a drone is just a drone. Sometimes an absent sitcom husband is just an absent sitcom husband. But, you know, we were theorizing that, like, maybe Bryan Cranston could come in, and then it could be a fun little, like, meta sitcom dad moment. Michael had another theory. He said, I was listening to the podcast, and I love the idea of Bryan Cranston as Mephisto, but based on the quotes you guys read out, I have a second contender for a possible Mephisto, John Goodman. He can play lovable dad patriarch, has a long lineage in Roseanne, so the King meta aspect Ralph works, but can also be the image of devil incarnate, as exemplified when he played Carl Madman Munt in Barton Fink. He is already in the Disney family, as he's currently on ABC's The Conners. And one more possible clue, coincidence, he was the titular character in King Ralph. So maybe Agnes's Ralph is a literal Ralph. Anyway, love the pod. Thought I'd throw the theory in. So, I don't know how this all works together. If it's possible that the FBI's missing man is Ralph / possibly also Mephisto, is Agnes's absent husband, is played by John Goodman and or Bryan Cranston. But I like all of that sort of that whole suit.
Sure.
What do you think?
I think, okay, good. I think we should stretch a little, because this is quite a reach. You know, we don't want to pull anything, but okay.
For sure. Yeah, we're here to reach. Like, what else are we doing here? You know, if not to reach.
I think it's a fun theory. All right. I definitely think the mystery of who is the missing person is going to be key to the overall story. And,
correct.
You know, I don't know how this ties in to, like, so what, you know, however that fits in as part of the puzzle pieces, we do have some key pieces of information, and that's, you know, things like the hexagonal shape. I was trying to think about what in nature is hexagonal in shape. You know, we have stop signs. So is this, like, metaphorical? You know, when she sees something she doesn't like, she stops it. She throws Monica Rambeau out of the universe. I'm not quite sure what became of the beekeeper, but, like, clearly she brought a halt to that.
I'm worried about the beekeeper.
Yeah. He just vanished.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about the fact that he was a beekeeper. And you remember one of the things I think we got right is that she is interpreting like a hazmat suit in a way that fits into her universe. But the more I started to scratch my head about that, I'm like, yeah, but why would a beekeeper emerging from a sewer fit into your universe? That's not normal, right? Yeah. It's not like he was in a bee, like some sort of like field of flowers with his bees nests. And that made me think, oh, bees nest, honeycomb. The honeycomb shapes of individual cells are hexagons. And what do we have? What's the key figure in any honeycomb or any bee's nest is the queen bee, right?
Queen bee, for sure.
So is Wanda the queen bee? Everybody else?
Wanda the queen bee? Is Agnes the queen bee? Agatha? If there's one person to be described as a queen bee that we've seen so far in the series, in the universe, that would be Emma Caulfield's character, Dottie, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's the queen bee of the neighborhood, right?
Exactly. So it's like the bee thing, I think, can't be discounted as mere just disguise or way to fit in because it's too weird, you know?
It is very weird. I did like that the little bit of rope that was attached to him got turned into a jump rope.
Yes, that was cool.
That was pretty cute. So let's talk about the
hexagon and the bee shape and the queen bee. That's all got to be part of it. If you think about, there was also the line Monica says, well, usually the drone accompanies me. So Monica's kind of a queen bee, if you think about it.
Sure. Maybe
if we're sticking with the drones bee metaphor.
Sure.
You know, drones. So and the humans in this
is all about
town.
Yes anding. This is all about, this is like basically an improv, evening at the improv in this section. Let's just yes and each other's Ricci theories and be down with it. You know what I mean?
It does, so sure, you know, all the humans in under the dome are kind of like drones. They don't have their own lives, right? They're doing, they only kind of exist when they're in her orbit. So I do think she's in control. The question is who gave her these tools and who created this? I'm not so sure that maybe she did it herself, but Agnes and Ralph saw a way to benefit themselves by slipping in, or maybe they set her up for this. I think we will find out.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can kind of be both like a setup that leads to her creating it. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, a very common theory. If you believe in the Mephisto of it all, a very common idea is this is a deal with the devil. She's made a deal with the devil so that she could have her reality, have her, you know, husband reanimated. And the price possibly are her children. Like that's what he needs from the bargain. So even though she's made the dome, it's not like she made it all on her own. Do you know what I mean? So
deals with the devil. Devil always needs you to strike a deal, right?
Yeah.
It's never, the devil doesn't just come get you. You've got to open the door in some way.
No free lunch with the devil. Let's talk about Dottie really quickly. So there's this line in her episode, in the second episode when we meet her, where Agnes says she's the key to everything in the town. And on the surface, you take that to mean like societally, right? But we're looking below the surface on every line here, right? So she's the key to everything in the town. Here's a really fun theory. Ready? Get limber. We're going to stretch. Are you ready for it? So in the show, the character is Dottie Jones. Her husband's name is Phil Jones. There's a character in the comics called Arcana Jones, who has a husband named Phil Jones. And so she's also like a witch figure. I think it's interesting that Agnes doesn't have a driver's license attached to her piece of paper on their little like wall. But I think it's even more interesting that Dottie isn't there at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we talked last week about the movie marquee and how it had that like, I don't even remember the name of the Sam Raimi Wizard of Oz movie.
Oz the Great and the Terrible.
Oz the Great and Terrible.
Or but Great and the Powerful, right?
That's three witches, right? Isn't it? In that movie? So is this a trio of witches? Is Mephisto a misdirect? You know, which you were skeptical about to begin with. But is all the Mephisto stuff a misdirect? And is it just going to come down to, like, three women instead? Maybe. I don't know. I'm skeptical of Dottie. Arcana also goes by Moonglow. Arcana, born with an aptitude for wielding magical energies. Where she learned to control these abilities is unknown, but as an adult, Arcana worked as a medium. After marrying Phil Jones, she decided to support her family by working as a professional crime fighter while her husband stayed home to raise their children. She was part of the Squadron Supreme. Squadron Supreme. So, there you go. Just keeping our eye on Emma Caulfield of Buffy fame. See what happens there.
Well,
To go back to that idea about color, like the most disturbing incident that happened involving color was her blood, right? Mm-hmm. Blood magic being like a big deal and stuff like that. So like if she saw the blood, was worried about Wanda, you know, breaking this reality bubble she's created, perhaps she engineered the switch to color. Is one thought. Another thought is, like, you know, if you think about Dottie being some sort of driver behind things, she's the one who keeps saying for the children, for the children, for the children in episode two. So I don't know, just, you know, something to keep our eye on. Villains hiding in plain sight, you know.
I think so. That's one thing about Marvel is, once, you know, we can theorize all we want, usually, I mean, traditionally in all the movies and everything, we guess ourselves into the stratosphere on the trailers and the little materials and photos and hints and interviews and things like that. And then the solution turns out to be pretty simple. Like, the resolution is always fairly easy to comprehend. It's never anything all that Byzantine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't expect we will need to have to know about archaic comic lore to understand WandaVision. This is all created to be very viewer friendly. I mean, that's what this whole episode four is. Like, okay, press pause, pull out. We're going to show you everything that's been happening. We're going to explain a lot to you. We're going to give you a little misdirect at the end, which is saying Wanda, it's all Wanda. I don't think it is all Wanda, but like, this is a very hold the audience's hand episode, right?
Yes. This is the episode, I think, like, people like me were waiting for, like, because I don't think my kids will enjoy the show because they don't know the sitcom tropes and they're, you know, they're kids, so they're impatient. And, like, we want to show this to them when they can watch it and also get, like, simultaneous explanation because they're not going to enjoy the guesswork. I think I mentioned previously my daughter was watching and she gave me a big smile, but she was like, I have no idea what's happening. I don't know what this is or what any of it is. So I think, like, this is the part you get to where you go, okay, at least now if I know nothing about any of this, I at least have a grasp of where I am. It orients you.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about Sword and Shield and all of what's going on here. You know, we see Monica, you know, return from the snap. Her mother, who we met and like loved in Captain Marvel, in Captain Marvel, you know, has passed away from cancer. It's really a traumatic return for her. Yes. She's back to work in just a couple weeks. We find out, like, via some swift and tidy exposition that her mother created Sword, which is not canonical to the comics, but I quite like it. I like this idea that Peggy Carter created Shield and Maria Rambeau created Sword. These two women created these, like, massive agencies. A question some folks might be asking is, if Sword has been around for a little while, why is this the first we're really hearing of it in the MCU? And a fun answer to that is that up until the Fox merger, Fox retained the rights to Sword. So they couldn't have Sword in the MCU before now. So they're going to do a whole, this was here the whole time sort of move with that. Do you have any Sword thoughts here?
I have a lot of questions about Sword and about this guy who's leading it, Tyler Hayward, acting director, who something about him seems off. I'm not sure I trust that dude. I don't know he's a Skrull. I don't know if he's just a bad dude who is an opportunist. I don't know. There's just something about his leadership that gives me pause. But I thought that opening sequence where Monica rematerializes and then there's just panic in the hospital and she's running into people and not sure who's returned and who's just been around and is dealing with this. The panic there, I don't know that. And then the grief of finding out that this mother that she was just with is gone and gone for years and she was gone for years. It was really affecting. I found myself getting choked up watching it. Yeah. It was beautifully performed. And I thought again, we've seen this a bunch of times in the Marvel movies, the snap and then, I don't know, the return from the snap. But I thought it was pretty emotional and heavy. And it also confronts you with the notion that some things don't come back. You know, her mother isn't coming back. And that shot a few minutes later where Wanda looks up at Vision and he's zombified. He's corpse-like and he has the horrific hole in his head where the Mind Stone was. You know, as much as we try to delude ourselves with quote-unquote magical thinking, no pun intended, sometimes reality intercedes and we just have to deal with it.
What do you make of... I really love that. What do you make of... what we see of Vision here. What does this tell you about what's going on with Vision?
It tells me he's not there. I don't think he's there.
So, like there at all, or she has his, like, corpse and is puppeting around this pocket universe?
I don't know. That's venturing into some pet cemetery territory.
It's very gruesome. It's very gruesome.
That's pretty gruesome. I think that's too gruesome for Marvel, but... Maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, we are dealing with witches and scary stuff and magic, so maybe. But I think it's more just a reminder of what he looked like when he died. But I don't know. What do you do with Vision's body? Do you bury it? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure we ever got an answer to that.
Apparently, Kevin Feige said in an interview that they originally had a post-credit scene planned for Endgame where Wanda goes to see Vision's body in the morgue. Now, I don't know if they shot it and are going to use that here in WandaVision as like an inciting incident of trauma or what. But I still have a lot of questions about this.
And we've theorized before that it's not Vision, but somebody else who can move with super speed. And
right. Is it Simon Williams? Is it Vision's body? I don't know. I have a lot of questions.
Could Vision be performed by the missing person?
Could be. The other thing, I talked to Richard about this a little bit, so I don't mean to like totally retread, but in Infinity War, the whole thing that Shuri is trying to do is like sort of rewire Vision so that he can exist without the Mind Stone, right?
Yes.
And it is unclear how successful she was before she got ashed. You know, obviously he seems very lifeless when the Mind Stone gets pulled out of his body. But did she get most of the way there? There's history in the comics of them resurrecting Vision after he dies at the hand of Wanda. But he just doesn't remember her. So... did Vision come back and not remember her and she couldn't handle that? And that was an inciting incident for her. You know, there's some questions there, but I'm not the Vision that we knew is dead. I think that's true no matter what. But I'm not sure we have the full answer of what's going on with him yet. Do you know, was she remembering?
I don't think so.
Yeah. All right. The episode did end with the song Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix, which makes you feel like we're talking zombies here, reanimated corpses, maybe something like that. So,
I think it's notable which part of Voodoo Child they played.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. There's a particular lyric. It kind of, you know, they pick it up midway through the song. And the lyrics that, the it's not, I don't know what you can interpret from this, but the primary lyric that we hear is, if I don't meet you no more in this world, then I'll meet you on the next one, and don't be late. Because I'm a voodoo child. Voodoo child. So, like, there's definitely, like, there are other worlds than these implied by that song. I mean, it's a great song, and it's about voodoo. There's so that's magic. You know, you got a hint of witchcraft, but they chose a very particular part of that song. A lot of the rest of the song is about being powerful. You know, when I stand up next to a mountain and I chop it with the edge of my hand, we'll pick up all the pieces and make an island, might even raise a little sand. So that part's not in the show, but, it's in the song. And so, like, this is a little island that they're on, right? I don't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you one of these days. That's another part of the lyric. And then again, if I don't meet you no more in this world, I'll meet you in the next.
Can you do a dramatic reading of every closing song going forward?
I will. Yeah, I know. I don't want to be too Shatner, though. I hope my reading wasn't. I'm a voodoo child. You
know? Do you feel like trailer footage that Marvel has released is fair game to talk about?
Yeah. Sure.
They released a new spot that was sort of forward looking, as shows often do mid season. And in it, there appears to be footage of Vision breaking out of the bubble. Because as we see in this episode, you know, like every episode, he starts to get like whoever he or that thing is starts to get more and more uneasy with what's going on. And we see him break out of the bubble and then seemingly collapse. Which would reinforce sort of this idea, you know, he tells Wanda we can go anywhere, and she's like, nope, we can't. And I think that's because, like, whatever this is, if it's the corpse of Vision, if it's a different version of Vision, if it's a man she has reimagined to be Vision, it can't exist outside the bubble, unlike Monica's groovy clothes. And so, you know, that's something to be worried about. Vision wants out, but what will that do to him if he gets out? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I don't think it's a corpse that falls out. I think, again, that'd be a little gruesome, but
it's really creepy. I agree.
I think there's some raw material, some entity, some being that she's cast as Vision, you know? And maybe that's the, as I said before, maybe that's the missing person. But whenever you fall out of the bubble... Even Monica Rambeau experienced this.
Like, oh, that's true. You got to take a nap.
You've got like a little bit of like a stunned reacclimation to
your bubble hangover. Yeah. You're right. All right. But another thing that we saw in this footage is this interesting moment from the Family Ties episode, which should be next week, episode 8, the episode 5, the 80s episode, where the character of Agnes, Catherine Hahn's character, sort of breaks for a second and she looks at one and she goes, should we start from the top or what? And so this sort of moment of like, you're the boss and we're all your actors, what do you want us to do here? Like a really meta moment, right? Do you want to hear a really fun meta theory that I heard about Quicksilver that, you know, we're okay. So we were thinking that maybe Quicksilver might show up in the 80s episode, the Family Ties episode, because they have already said that they are doing the Tom Hanks drinks vanilla extract, drunk uncle episode. And maybe so is Uncle Pietro, who has shown up here. I read a fun theory that like, Uncle Pietro shows up, he's played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and then, like, he gets recast at some point, and it's Evan Peters. And that would be, like, a nice little meta Bewitched moment, like a nod to the two Darrens and Bewitched or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I just really like that idea. Do you have any reaction to that?
I dig that it. I like that, and I like being in the alternate universe version of him. So, yeah, I'm down.
All right. Two final things. One is I want us to keep our eye on the mailman who has this super interesting line in episode 2 where he says, "Don't shoot, I'm just the messenger." I just want to flag it and remember it going forward. We haven't really revisited that guy, but I just want to think about it. And then the last thing I want to talk about is this idea of like, this being a Wanda villain origin story, potentially. This comes from our listener, Jordan, this email. Loving the newest season. I think this is setting up Wanda as the next villain of the MCU. A very original theory, I know. But what is compelling to me is the human aspect of that theory. In this reality, Wanda has everything she's yearned for. She has Vision and the twins and a simple life of happiness. She's not going to accept this reality as false so easily, and who among us would? In Game of Thrones, when Daenerys sees Drogo and their baby in the House of the Undying, she knows it's an illusion, but Drogo says if this is a dream, he would kill anyone who tried to wake them up. This response is so human, and I find myself really sympathetic to Wanda. If someone tried to rescue me from my very nice and comfortable life, what they claimed as a false reality, I don't know if I'd be willing to believe them. And if I had, say the most powerful magic in the universe, I might just tear down worlds to stop them from taking it away. Also, if Vanity Fair exists in the MCU canon, does that mean Still Watching exists somewhere out in the MCU canon? Just curious. Thanks for all the great content, Jordan. That's because Richard and I talked last week about the fact that Leslie Bibb plays a Vanity Fair reporter in Iron Man. So, Vanity Fair is MCU canonical.
You know what's funny is in Iron Man, there's also a journalist on the red carpet line at like the charity event that Jeff Bridges' character attends, and the guy that the reporter who is on camera, like in a two shot interviewing Jeff Bridges when Tony Stark shows up, when Robert Downey Jr. turns up alive, is my good friend Scott Bowles, my former movie writing colleague at USA Today. So we always kind of joked that like he was on set, he visited the set of that scene, and Jon Favreau just put him in as a reporter and gave him like a great. Like he's on screen, he's there, not just in the background. And I think originally he even had a couple of lines that they got. But I always like to think that that's really my friend Scott Bowles at playing himself, USA Today reporter. So the fact that there's a Leslie Bibb Vanity Fair writer, why not? We exist. We are in the MCU. We're canon. I declare it. We're canon.
We're here. We're reporters, get used to it. All right, so this last email comes from Irvin, and he's just got like a bunch of points. He had one point about Billy and Tommy and their gayness, which Richard and I covered in depth in the first segment, so we will skip that part. But here are a few other things. He says, in the comics, Agatha Harkness has a son called Nicholas Scratch, and on the show, Agnes has a pet rabbit called Senior Scratchy. Also, Agatha was at one point the nanny to Franklin Richards, the son of Mr. Fantastic and Invisible Woman of the Fantastic Four, which could put her in a position to continue in the MCU after the Fox acquisition. Number two, it seems to me that Agnes may be being used by Mephisto, perhaps, to perpetuate this bubble/ruse with Wanda, as she seems a bit unwilling in the situation, as seen by her chat at the hedge and by her general annoyance with Ralph. Next point, to me it is unclear if the force creating this American sitcom reality is someone more American in identity, or if Wanda is basing it on her viewing of American reruns on TV as a Sokovian kid. Wanda wanted a classic American name like Tommy for her baby, which shows that perhaps she's trying to create an idealized American family life that is the one she saw on TV and has longed to have for herself. At the end of episode 2, though, Wanda is suddenly pregnant, it seems to genuinely ask Vision, is this really happening? Which makes me think that she is not fully in control of this reality. And lastly, Wanda and Vision's house in all decades has been numbered 2800, despite the house itself changing each time, which seems due to online research to perhaps be their home in the Marvel multiverse, or could have another meaning that we have not discovered. Avengers comic issues numbers do not go that high, but issue 280 is about a sick Jarvis, so that does not seem to fit at all. Signed, Urban. That's the kind of rabbit hole I go down all the time. I think the population of Westview in this episode we learn is like 3892, and I definitely googled like 3892 Marvel meaning comics issues numbers, like all this sort of thing, to try to see if it's something. And then, you know what, Anthony, sometimes a drone is just a drone, you know.
Sometimes it is. It's just we need house numbers on this.
Do you have any reactions to any of that comic lore there.
Maybe. Not really. I'm not sure numerology ever adds up to much. Again, no pun intended. I think the population of the town was just to show us that it's not like a town of 200,000, that it's a very small town.
Yeah.
So that's probably the reason for that information was conveyed. The house number, like, maybe, I don't know, like, I'm not sure what, should we divide it by six and see what we get?
Okay, all right.
You know, what is it, 28000? We can, I think at a certain point you get a little kooky, but that's what we're here for, is to be a little kooky, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, I just remember Lost, and the numbers, they didn't ever add up to anything. They never really signified anything, did they? It was just a code.
Kind of. Yes and unknown. I don't know. there's an Avengers Earth 2800 that exists in, there's like different Earths, right?
All
right,
then maybe that. I could go, see, that I'm much more likely to go along with.
Okay. So, you know,
it exists. That house number is definitely pronounced. Like, you notice it every time it turns
Yeah.
out.
No, and I wasn't saying the population definitely means something. I'm just saying anytime I do see a number, maybe it's my Lost training, I will write it down and see if I can, like, figure out some sort of significance to it. It doesn't always pay off, is my point. Sometimes a drone is just a drone, you know?
Yeah. So what about, here's a character we haven't brought up before.
Okay.
But we know he gets his own show soon, and he's kind of a devilish character. He's got horns. You know who I'm talking about.
Loki.
Could he
you think
be part
Loki
of this?
Is behind it? Ooh. Well, so here's the problem. Here's the problem with trying to, you know, the problem with thinking too hard about how this leads into Doctor Strange is that whatever happens at the end of this season is going to have to hold through multiple Marvel stories until we get Doctor Strange, which they are only filming now, right? So we know that Wanda is in Doctor Strange, and maybe she's a villain in Doctor Strange, but she's not going to be, like, bopping around the universe villainously unchecked for the entire time between the end of WandaVision and when Doctor Strange premieres, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like whatever, I feel like there will be a continuation of the story, but whatever happens at the end of WandaVision is maybe it's like a post-credit subtle nod to us, the audience, but the world in general doesn't know that, like, Mephisto got out or Agnes got out or something like that. Do you know? And that can wait until Doctor Strange, but it can't be like Wanda has ripped a hole in reality or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it can't be so universe breaking that we have to be expected to, like, sit through, Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Loki and Black Widow and whatever else is standing between us and Doctor Strange.
Yes. Okay, so instead of yes and, I'll say yes but. But, like, as we saw with the beginning of this episode, you can have events taking place concurrently. So, you know, we might get Falcon and Winter Soldier and their adventure might be something that's happening, like, simultaneously to what's going down in WandaVision. So, you know, I do think that it's part of the language of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that years can pass and multiple stories can happen, and we're still, like, kind of close to the same era, you know?
Totally. Absolutely possible. I just want to think about, like, I want to think about the kind of storytelling that they want to tell that won't be too confusing for their audience. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's already, like, the timeline's already a little, like, scattershot in that Far From Home takes place months after this, because this is only a few weeks after the return from the snap.
Totally.
And Far From Home is, I think it's supposed to be like 8 months. So plotting things around like that is a little tough when you're asking folks in a more casual way to come along for the ride, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's interconnected. If it's not, it matters less. You know, like, I don't really care when Loki takes place if it doesn't, but if it ties in directly, like, if Loki bops from this over to his show, like, that's, we've got another show in between to get through. Do you know?
Yeah, definitely. But also, like, Okay, so Loki dies in the universe, the prime universe of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And he lives in the Altvern universe where he makes off with the Space Stone. And with the with the Tesseract. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Space Stone, right? I got my stones. I need a little cheat sheet. Maybe he wants to find a way to assimilate those timelines, but also be alive. So could he be manipulating Wanda? Like, she's a powerful magic wielder. Maybe she can resurrect me, bring me back. Well, I'm not going to test it on me. I'm going to test it on Vision, you know?
Listen, I never want to underestimate Loki. I've made that mistake before. So, you know, never underestimate his capacity for mischief. I don't know. It's so interesting. It's interesting, especially given the way the schedule had to move around with their Disney Plus shows. That makes me feel like I do feel like they're going to use these various shows to seed characters and lead into things. But maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like the connection can't be. So airtight as that. Do you know what I mean?
Not. Yeah. Starts to shrink.
I don't mean to no but your theory. I will go for all theories. And I'm always excited for Tom Hiddleston to show up. I mean, I'm still trying to think of who it is that Paul Bettany would be like, I get to work with an actor I've never worked with before who's legendary, blah blah. And I'm like, well, I mean, has he shared scenes with Tom Hiddleston? Would he count Benedict Cumberbatch? To me, that means someone who's been around even a little longer. Because Paul Bettany's been around longer than those guys, right? So to me, it's someone who's been around a little longer. I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else you want to say about this episode before we hit the road?
I'm looking forward to getting back to the sitcom world.
Me too.
This was a nice. You know, we interrupt this broadcast. Good title, too. Very clever.
Yeah, very cute. All right. So until next time, where can folks find you, Anthony?
You can just find me writing away at vanityfair.com.
You can find me also there as well as Richard. You can find Richard on Twitter at Rylaws. I'm at Joe Wrote This. Please let me know what I missed. But do remember that I did make note of Jimmy Woo's magic trick in part one, so you could save your emails and tweets about that. Much love to you. All right.
All right. Bye.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now,